This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica stations, and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Most progressive Americans, particularly those who supported Bernie Sanders' primary election bid, knew that post-election political organizing was going to be crucial, even with a Hillary Clinton win. But with Donald Trump as our unexpected president-elect, the stakes are far, far higher than we imagined. Today, as Trump picks one extremist after another to fill cabinet positions, rather than the feeling of dread and demoralization that is fast spreading over the nation, my guest offers a path forward. Becky Bond is senior advisor on the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. She was an architect of the campaign's national volunteer-driven grassroots campaign, also former political director at Credo and co-founder of Credo Super PAC, together with her co-senior advisor on the Sanders campaign, Zach Exley. She has written a new book called Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. She now joins me. Welcome to the program, Becky.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be on. I'm a longtime fan.
Thank you so much for joining us. All right. So clearly the title of your book is alluding to the classic handbook that Saul Alinsky wrote many, many years ago, Rules for Radicals. Saul Alinsky, the very well-known organizer who really kind of revolutionized the way people can organize and put together these very simple rules that he learned simply by doing them. Is that basically what you're sort of spinning off of, at least in your title?
Yeah, so, you know, like a lot of organizers in the progressive movement, I was trained by people who were trained in the Alinsky model. And this was a model that has been, you know, very powerful in community organizing, but it's also a model that's really, it's really emphasized a sort of incrementalist, one-by-one, rock-piling approach to organizing, something that when you have a long time to make change, and you can go from advocating for a stop sign to advocating for a stoplight to trying to put someone on the county council can be very powerful. But right now we need urgent and rapid change immediately. And so we thought it was time to do an update of the Saul Alinsky classic and talk about ways in which people with an urgent cause and a lot of folks willing to work for it could start doing big organizing and change everything.
Right. So Alinsky's model was based on those one at a time conversations, individual to individual. That is, of course, very much applicable still today for day-to-day kind of influencing your community. But when you are, say, trying to organize a primary campaign with just a few months, starting with a person who has little name recognition but a big vision, you need a different approach. However, of course, as your book points out, this is a model. These rules are ways to think about organizing outside of political campaigns, too. Let's talk about what your biggest rule and your first rule was, which is about the big ask. People feel like, especially organizers feel like, how do you get people to do something outside their comfort zone? Maybe you can get them to attend a protest, but can you get them to say, get arrested? Explain your first big rule, how asking them to do something big is actually key.
We know what was sort of amazing about the Bernie Sanders primary campaign, and I think this is relevant in a lot of our struggles, is that Bernie asked for something big. He didn't just ask for people's vote. He says we need millions of people to rise up and build a political revolution. And I think a lot of people, when he first started saying that, thought he was crazy. But then as it happened, hundreds of thousands of people started volunteering and millions of people got involved. And so Bernie would not have started a political revolution had he not asked for one. And this is certainly something that a lot of movements are experiencing, not just what we learned on the Bernie Sanders campaign, but people are just waiting to be asked to do something big if you're working to win something big. And I think the progressive movement and both politicians and, you know, advocacy organizations, they've really focused on asking people to do small things to win small things. And as it turns out, you know, people are really less motivated to go for even a small action that leads to a small result. But if you say, hey, we're going to pursue, you know, a solution that's as radical as the problem we face, we're going to win the big change that we really need, whether it's about dismantling structural racism or working to slow climate change, people are really ready to stand up and do something big if it's going to get us towards winning the big change that we really need.
So explain the role that you and Zach Exley, your co-writer in this book, had in the Sanders campaign. You had a huge task in front of you. Were you sort of little bit making it up as you went along to see what worked, what didn't work, but then also bringing to it your years of organizing in places like Credo?
Yeah, you know, we were part of this. Important to understand, we were a sort of a fringe part of the traditional presidential primary campaign. So the Bernie Sanders campaign had these huge, amazing, and traditional field operations happening on the ground in Iowa, New Hampshire in particular. A woman named Julia Barnes ran a magnificent operation there. But, you know, where presidential primary campaigns tend to focus on the first four contests, there's like 46 other states. Not to mention D.C. and a bunch of territories where we had these amazing activists and community members who really wanted to get to work to help win the political change that Bernie Sanders was talking about. So we were part of this sort of vast, we were tasked with this vast outpost of the campaign and putting people who cared about, you know, income inequality, structural racism, climate change, immigration reform, and all these other states, how we could put them to work as part of the campaign. And it's not a traditional thing. But luckily, we live at this moment where, you know, people across the country understand that we need big change and they want to be part of it. And we were able to use a lot of consumer technology that companies are using to help teams work across space and time. We actually use these kinds of free software like Slack and Google Apps to actually put supporters of a radical agenda to work for this presidential primary campaign. And we think this is something social justice organizations and groups of committed, concerned, you know, activists across the country can put to work to do big things with or without a presidential candidate.
Right. I mean, a lot of people feel daunted by the idea of running a big campaign because, of course, when you think big, you also have to think, can I afford this? Where's the money going to come from? Tell us about the story of how the fears of where's the money going to come from ended up being unfounded when the Sanders campaign just became flooded with hundreds of thousands of small donations, and how in the end you realized the small donation tip is the way to go.
Well, I mean, I think it's amazing to think if we actually have a message that resonates with people, people are willing to chip in to make it a reality. And so instead of spending time talking to really wealthy people or a super or their super PACs or trying to, you know, cozy up to corporations, that what we actually have to do is put together an agenda for change that appeals to people across the United States. And when we did this on the campaign, people really responded. And, you know, we had over 2.8 million people that donated to the campaign. The average donation was $27, but also lesser known is that the average age of a donor was 28 years old.
Wow.
And so, you know, people who think we can't do big things without a huge budget and a huge staff, in reality, if you actually have a compelling, you know, big agenda and you're willing to invite people in to do that work together as a movement, that you can actually, you can actually have amazing, committed, passionate, and talented volunteers take key leadership roles in the campaign. And then also the movement can fund itself
right,
with small dollar donations that can be collected online.
Now, having been with Pacifica for many years, I know, you know, firsthand that this idea of having lots and lots of people make small donations, a sort of membership model, can be much more stable than when groups rely on small numbers of big funders. So taking the thing that you learned from this campaign and applying it to a non-electoral campaign situation, how do you make the case to an organization that wants to do big things that they can fund themselves through small donations rather than having to kowtow to big donors? Because, of course, foundational money comes with very serious strings attached. They want lots of accountability. They want, and sometimes you end up tempering your message to what you think. Often you end up tempering your message to what you think the foundation is looking for, rather than saying, here's what we need to get done.
That's right. And I think if you have a message that resonates with people and you are working on an agenda for change that people really want to see, then actually, you know, you have something that people are willing to give money and invest in small dollar donations. If you can't get people to support your project, maybe you have the wrong project. And I think this is something that people, you know, want to ask about. You know, one good example, for example, in the climate justice movement is fracking. A lot of big environmental organizations didn't want to talk about a ban on fracking, you know, because of relationships that they had with industry. But as we've seen, a lot of the energy in the climate movement is regular people getting involved in these anti-fracking fights because, you know, this is something that they understand is a huge threat to our communities and to our water. And so when people are actually willing to talk about things that that people want to be involved in, you can actually get a lot of people and a lot of donations to come in where bigger organizations that are dependent upon a smaller number of, you know, wealthy foundations or wealthy individuals, they may not actually be able to address and build support for the project at hand. And I think it's really important for an organization to have a base of people that are supporting and responding, because it's very easy to get off track and start working on things that are unimportant or not really important to the people if you don't have that direct feedback loop where you have volunteers involved, where you're speaking with people, and where people have an opportunity not just to volunteer but also give money to support your movement.
Right. Let's talk about the mechanics of how you sort of control a giant, very sort of loosely put together group of people. I mean, the kind of work that you and Zach did, it was essentially to help mobilize thousands upon thousands of people all over the country. I can imagine that unless you really had a plan from the start, it could get messy very fast and sometimes even counterproductive. So how did you lay out, you know, what your goals were, which was, of course, to get Sanders on the primary ticket, was to get him nominated. And then how did you go about focusing this large mass of people into actually being productive toward that goal?
Well, you know, with a presidential campaign, there's a deadline, and you know, it's clear what you need to do. You need to get your candidate to have more votes than the other candidate, and there's tactics for making that happen. And so we had the benefit of having a fairly simple task, but there are principles that apply to any kind of fight where the cause is urgent and you have a lot of supporters who want to be involved. And that idea was that, you know, we had to take all of this energy in the grassroots, and we had to create a structure so that they could actually contribute to a centralized plan to win. And this is really different than a lot of times you hear people talk about let 1,000 flowers bloom, let everybody do their own thing. And while there are many wonderful things about that, you could have a situation where you have enough people doing enough work that you could actually win something, but because they're not all pointed in the same direction or working on the same tasks that add up to victory, you're going to have just enough work expended, but you're not going to actually win your objective. So it was our duty on the campaign. What we were tasked with was taking all of these people willing to do work for this progressive vision and help plug them into a system and a structure that no matter where they were in the country, that they could actually take on tasks that were part of the campaign's plan to win. And this isn't just something that works for, you know, a presidential campaign. There are all sorts of campaigns that progressive organizations run or that people run in their own community where work can be divided up among volunteers to get things done. And that people can come together in meetings and decide on an objective and work together to win. For example, in the climate justice movement, you know, we see people working to shut down parts of the fossil fuel infrastructure. That takes people being able to plan actions. That takes inviting people to come. That takes training people. That takes being available and doing different parts of the action on the ground. And much of this work doesn't have to be done by paid staff. It can actually be done by volunteers bringing their talents and life experience together. They just have to be given a structure and a schedule and a central plan to win that they can plug into. And so, you know, we're very optimistic that the energy that we saw in the Bernie Sanders campaign is something that we're going to see carried into lots of other movements where volunteers having run major operations and major part of the campaign will understand that what they have to contribute is more valuable than just their small dollar contributions. And then instead they can be leading and empowering all sorts of movements, whether they're local or national in focus.
Right. So the key here is, and this might sound counterintuitive, is that you have a distribution of the work, but the plan is centralized. And I know for a lot of people on the left, the idea of a centralized plan feels counterintuitive. We don't like taking orders. We're a rebellious lot, right, by nature. But of course, for people who've worked for many years in organizing, who've been part of movements that spring up sometimes seemingly naturally, that without a little bit of a centralized plan, everything can fall apart really fast, and then all of a sudden it was all for nothing. So can you sort of make that case for why a centralized plan with a group of people organizing to lay that out is important, even if it sometimes rubs us the wrong way?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the important thing about the centralized plan to win is that, you know, that winning the, some of the things that are on the table for us right now, you know, resisting Trump. Let's take, you know, I live in San Francisco, California, and San Francisco is a sanctuary city, but a lot of immigrants who live in San Francisco, they may commute out to other communities to work, which are not sanctuary cities. And for them to be protected, you know, it's not just going to take a bunch of individual acts of solidarity, people willing to identify as allies or people willing to do individual things. We actually need to organize together to ensure that, you know, our local law enforcement officials, not just in one place, but in the entire region, you know, refuse to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement officials, right? And so how do we do that? We need a centralized plan to win, not a lot of people individually showing solidarity towards immigrants, but we need a plan to take all of the counties around San Francisco and ensure that they pass resolutions in their town where the city councils are instructing the police not to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. And so if we have that centralized plan and it makes sense to people, then we can say, okay, here's how you convince your municipality to join San Francisco in being a sanctuary city. It's like, first you need to contact your city council members, then you need to show up at this meeting, then you need to have public information, then you also need to be showing up and contacting the head of the police and the civilian police boards. And so this is how we go from individual acts of solidarity and a lot of people caring and being involved to actually having a strategy that's going to protect people and achieve our goal, which is not to have families broken up and deported under a Trump regime. And you can think about this in terms of, you know, lots of different social change objectives that we must have. And it's not up to me to say what the central plan is. Anyone who has a smart idea can put it out to the community and invite people to be part of it. And the good thing is that people are smart and they understand what is a powerful plan that would actually solve the problem that we have. And so if you put a plan out there and no one wants to be part of it, probably your plan is not good enough. But if you have a good idea, you don't have to wait for a big advocacy organization to put a lot of money and staff behind it. You can start recruiting volunteers and put people behind it and make it a reality, because out there in our communities are all the leaders that we need to make change. And right now we have all these people post the election of Trump that are not just saying, they started out by saying, how could this happen here? But now they're saying, what can we do together? What can we do together to see the change we want in the world? And so I think a lot of things are going to be possible if we can work together.
Hmm. Becky, you do bring up one important issue-oriented point in your book, early in your book, Rule Number 4. And I have to say, I was very heartened and gratified to see that your Rule Number 4 is that fighting racism must be at the core of the message to everyone. And you pointed out that Bernie missed a crucial early opportunity to put race at the center of the message to everyone. Why do you bring this up, particularly now when we are being told that, quote-unquote, quote, identity politics is what, you know, helped Hillary Clinton lose this election, because all she was doing was appealing to ethnic groups and not really more broadly speaking. But this, I think, is a really important point.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you think so. On the Bernie campaign, and it's not about any one person, but, you know, the campaign is made up of a lot of people, and some people did amazing work, but some amazing surrogates like Nina Turner and Lucy Flores and many others, Ben Jealous, who did amazing work talking about the relationship of structural racism to income inequality and what we all have to do together to move the nation forward. But I think that the numbers show that we, and I speak for myself and the work that I did on the campaign, simply didn't do what the moment required. And to bring African American voters, and especially in the beginning more Latino voters, on board, so that together we could win the primary and make important change. And after the campaign, one of the things you have to look at on a campaign is, where did we succeed and where did we fail? And one of the things that Zach Exley and I did was we went and we looked at what did the Black intellectuals and Black leaders have to say about where the Bernie campaign, what we got right and what we got wrong. And that's where this rule came from, which is that, you know, they were right when they looked at specifically at the campaign, and they said that fighting racism should be part of the core message to everyone. It's not an added on concern for a certain constituency, and it's also something that is an impediment. We can't solve income inequality if we don't address structural racism. It simply can't happen. And we also have to make sure that everyone understands, not just Black people, but also white people really need to understand that, you know, the billionaires are using race to divide us and maintain control of our political system. And so we have to have an analysis that includes race, and that's not just for certain constituencies. So if we want to win, because here's the thing, it's going to take everybody to make change. And we need everybody working together. And in order to get everybody on board, we have to recognize that all of our issues are connected, and we have to fight for all of our issues at the same time. And too often in the progressive movement, we haven't included, dismantling structural racism as part of that core message that we all have to do together. And so this is something that if we want to win, we're going to have to change going forward. Because what we want is not to elect a certain candidate, but we want to build a more just society. And we can't do it without establishing fighting racism as part of the core message that we share with everyone that we're getting involved in the campaign.
Right. And of course, Sanders learned early on in his campaign, when he was confronted very publicly by Black Lives Matter, that he did need to incorporate that. And to his credit, he did have a very strong racial justice plank in his platform.
That's right.
And not all politicians would actually be open to accepting that sort of confrontational criticism. And we even learned from like movements like Occupy Wall Street, when there has been an ignoring of issues around race, that it has been detrimental to the movement as a whole. One of the other rules that really resonated with me in your book, Becky, was the chapter called Fight the Tyranny of the Annoying. And I have, you know, personally been in situations so many times when you are trying to get a group together, you're trying to organize for something, and all it takes is one very self-centered, annoying, domineering person who doesn't know when to shut up to basically destroy the whole group and scare new people from joining. And it can be very destructive. Did you have this happening in the Bernie, in the campaign that you and Zach worked on for Sanders? And if so, how does one deal with it?
Well, I think this is any time when you will, I mean, this is why a lot of organizations don't want to get volunteers involved in anything but the most low level and isolated tasks, is that, you know, whenever you bring people together to work together for change, whether even within where you're all paid staff, you know, you sometimes have people that are disruptive, even despite the best intentions. And I think that when you're working with volunteers, you're having empowering volunteers to take a role in the campaign, you also have to hold people accountable. Because one person, even with the best of intentions, can actually disrupt the work of a large group of people and drive the best people away when you need those people to make change. And so on the Bernie Sanders campaign and another progressive organizing that Zach and I have been involved in, is we've just taken responsibility for saying when someone is being disruptive and it gets to a point where others can't do their work or it's driving people away, you actually have to ask the disruptive person to leave. And I think in progressive politics, a lot of people are actually too polite to do this. But even someone who wastes 10 minutes of a 60 minutes meeting, you know, if you have, you know, dozens of people involved, that's hours and hours and hours of productive work time that's lost because you're unwilling to ask a volunteer who can't work in a constructive way to either stop what they're doing or else leave the group. And so I think this is one of the things that we all are familiar with if we volunteer, and it feels good just to admit it. That some people are disruptive, and we do have to fight the tyranny of the knowing, because if we don't, then people are going to, you know, turn away from people-powered, you know, movement-oriented campaigns. And we deeply believe that it's going to take all of us working together to make the change that we need to see. So we have to address this disruptive element.
So on the flip side, you also point out in your book the kinds of people you absolutely want in the kind of campaign that you were trying to run. And they were nurses. You literally have a chapter in your book saying, if there are no nurses, I don't want to be part of your revolution. I think paraphrasing Emma Goldman, that if there's no, what is it, dancing, I can't be part of your revolution. Why nurses?
Well, you know, the nurses are so amazing because in some ways they're an indicator species for everything you need to make a people-powered movement. You know, they're professionalized, but many working-class women. They're a very diverse group of caregivers who are really in touch with both the people and then also the policies that are failing the people in our country. And nurses, they really, like, what's amazing about nurses is they don't just care about healthcare policy, right? You have a lot of people that, you know, come together around a constituency group and they just work on that one issue in that silo. But nurses understand the impact of joblessness and the stress of that on people's health. They understand climate justice issues are making people sick, right? And they understand that, and that the failure of, you know, our government to provide, you know, childcare for women, you know, causes difficulty in, you know, the health of our children, right? And how they're able to actually, you know, be there for kids and give them the care that they need. So they understand that all these things are connected, and they treat the whole person, and they don't just care about healthcare policy. And so, you know, nurses are some of the hardest working, best leaders a movement can have. And so we believe, and one of the things that we saw in the Bernie Sanders campaign and in the environmental movement and in other justice movements is that when you have nurses on your side, you know that your cause is righteous, and you're going to attract the kinds of people that actually want to work together to address all the issues and win change that are going to help all the people, not just a self-interested constituency.
And then, Becky, the other thread through your book that I thought was also really interesting was learning the art of management. Again, this is the sort of thing that rubs, you know, lefties the wrong way, because the idea of management is a corporate idea, or we've decided it's a corporate idea because a corporate business culture has taken that on. But how important is that? And what do you specifically mean by, you know, learn how to be a good manager? What are some of the things that management experience can lend to a political organizing effort?
You know, I think sometimes whether you work for a nonprofit or you're part of a group of people working for change, you think your cause is so important that excuses people who don't treat other people with respect and don't respect their time and don't make efficient use of resources. And, you know, making the work of social change is really hard, and we have to act efficiently, and we also have to respect each other, and we have to work well together. And that involves hierarchy, but it also is about how we treat each other when we're working hard together. We can't just throw those things out the window because the cause is important. And one of the things that's actually most resonated with people that I've talked to about that is this part of management, which comes from the software industry. It's called eating your own dog food. And what that means is that staff need to participate in the activities that it's asking its customers or its volunteers, you know, to be part of. And that meant on the team that I was on Bernie, the distributed organizing team, it meant we weren't just asking people to phone bank. We weren't just asking people to hold community meetings. We actually did that work too. Right. And so, you know, if you were on staff, you also made phone calls to voters and used the software we were asking people to use so that you actually understood how well it was working and what the important things were, but also out of respect, because that's really important work and we are all in it together. And so I think creating a culture of where teams can be efficient, where everybody's in it together, where we respect the volunteers because we respect the work they're doing and we're willing to do it ourselves, that makes us all better at what we're trying to do.
And then sometimes you become the victim of your own success. How do you deal with the counter-revolution that when you start with a big idea and you start getting traction, you end up actually losing friends sometimes?
You know, this was a really tough one, and we wanted to put this in the book. And, you know, this book is really meant to be something that anyone who wants to make change, whether they're part of a group, whether they give money to a group, or whether just an individual activist, they can read it, and it gives them information they can use to get started and deal with the problems they encounter as they go along. And this rule about the counter-revolution, whenever there is a revolution happening, you know, there's often something pushing back against that revolution to stop it from happening. And we wanted people to know that a lot of times it's people who, you know, you see as being on the same side as you, will try and trip you up and stop you from making change. And we wanted people to know about this because it can be really hard to deal with when your friends who share the same beliefs, you know, tell you to stop doing what you're doing, that when you fight for not just the change that politicians say are possible, but the change we actually need to see, they tell you you're making things worse.
So I'm assuming that some Clinton supporters might have felt this way about the work you're doing for Bernie.
I think that's right. And it's not just on the Bernie campaign. I think on any campaign, sometimes there'll be a politician that says, you know, don't ask for a ban on fracking because you'll make it difficult for me to get regulations that'll make fracking safer. And what we want people to know is that, you know, actually, you know, the experts and the politicians, they don't always do the right thing. They don't always know the right thing. And so if your cause is righteous, you know, when people who are on should be on your same side, they're pushing back, there might be something more at stake than you're not doing the right thing. And we want people to be aware of that, because oftentimes these doubters and these naysayers slow us down. And I'll give an example. When President Obama was elected, you know, there was a lot of pressure to fight for a public option for healthcare instead of single payer healthcare, right? A single payer system, Medicare for all. And, you know, looking back on that time, and I was involved in that fight, had we been pushing for a single payer system when President Obama took office, we might have ended up with a public option. But because we started compromising with the compromise, we ended up with a compromise on the compromise.
So basically, aim for the stars. And if you're lucky, you might get something up there, but maybe not the stars. Don't start your fight asking for the clouds. Ask for the stars.
That's right. Ask for what we need to win to solve our problems. And some people who you thought would be with you are not going to be, and you need to be aware of that. You need to know how to deal with that. But whatever you do, don't stop fighting.
I think that's a great note to wrap up this conversation. There's many more things to talk about in the book. Really, I appreciated that you got into the kind of nuts and bolts of the modern day organizing. What we didn't get to was how you use digital technology that's available today, but certainly people can pick up a copy of Rules for Revolutionaries to understand how that aspect was something that you uncovered. Thank you so much, Becky, and good luck to you.
Oh, thanks for having me on the program. I really appreciate the work that you do.
My guest is Becky Bond, co-senior advisor with Zach Exley of the Bernie Sanders campaign. She and Zach have written a book that we've been discussing, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUwithSonali.